Welcome to The End of Innocence, the JFK Assassination. I'm your host, John Young, and welcome to Part 3 of the murder of Dallas Police Officer J.D. Tippit. A Rosetta Stone is defined as a key to some previously undecipherable mystery. In his 1973 book titled November 22, 1963, You Are the Jury, David Bellin, assistant counsel to the Warren Commission and one of the chief defenders of the Warren Report, asserts that, quote, the Rosetta Stone to the solution of President Kennedy's murder is the murder of Dallas Police Officer J.D. Tippit. Once it's admitted that Lee Harvey Oswald killed Patrolman J.D. Tippit, there can be no doubt that the overall evidence shows that Oswald was the assassin of John F. Kennedy, end quote. According to the Warren Report, roughly 45 minutes after President John F. Kennedy's assassination, Lee Harvey Oswald fatally shot Dallas Police Officer J.D. Tippit near the intersection of 10th Street and Patton Avenue in Oak Cliff. I've always thought that it was weird that Oswald would go out of his way to bring attention to himself by murdering a police officer if he had just killed the president. Wouldn't he just want to lay low? According to the Warren Report, Lee Harvey Oswald encountered Officer J.D. Tippit in Oak Cliff and realized the officer recognized him as matching the suspect's description in President Kennedy's assassination. At that moment, fearing capture, Oswald allegedly made a faithful decision to shoot and kill Officer Tippit. But decades later, doubts still linger. Was Oswald truly Tippit's killer? In last week's episode, we looked at first-hand accounts from those who witnessed the moment surrounding Officer J.D. Tippit's tragic death. We looked at what eyewitnesses said about the shooter. We also looked at what witnesses said happened during the brief and fatal encounter between Tippit and his killer. And perhaps most importantly, we heard if some of the witnesses actually identified Lee Harvey Oswald as the gunman. Today's episode dives into exonerating or at least compelling evidence that casts serious doubt on Oswald's guilt in the Tippit shooting. Why could witnesses not agree what the killer of J.D. Tippit was wearing? Were there witnesses that saw more than one gunman at the Tippit shooting? Why has maybe one of the most important witnesses to the J.D. Tippit shooting disappeared? What do the story of the shells found at the scene tell us? We're on a mission to find out, did Lee Harvey Oswald kill Dallas Police Officer J.D. Tippit? We've already explored the official narrative surrounding Officer J.D. Tippit's death and reviewed the Warren Report's eyewitness testimony. According to the report, 9 individuals identified Lee Harvey Oswald as the shooter, some through same-day police lineups, others via photo identifications conducted months later. On the surface, that's compelling evidence, potentially enough to secure conviction, assuming no exonerating evidence exists. But critics of the Warren Report argue that such evidence does exist. The first witness to significantly challenge the official account of Lee Harvey Oswald's involvement in the Officer J.D. Tippit murder and offer potentially exonerating testimony was Aquila Clements. Clements worked as a caregiver at a residence located at 327 East 10th Street, just steps away from the scene of the shooting. In 1966, attorney and Oswald advocate Mark Lane interviewed Clements for the documentary Rush to Judgment. During the interview, Clements stated that she had seen 2 men at the scene, not just one. She described one of them as, quote, short, chunky man, and the other man as thin and tall, end quote, neither of whom matched Oswald's appearance. According to Clements, the heavier man remained at the scene while the thinner man ran off. Even more troubling, Clemens claimed that shortly after the incident, she was approached by an unidentified man who warned her not to speak about what she had seen. She said she had feared for her safety and initially kept quiet because of that threat. Her account directly contradicts the official narrative, which asserts that Oswald acted alone. Clemens' testimony introduces the possibility of multiple suspects and suggests that witnesses' intimidation may have played a role in shaping the public story. Here's a clue of Clemens' story in her own words.
Mrs. Clemens, where were you on November 22, 1963?
I was working for Miss Schmidtman, 3-2-7-8-10, just where? Down the block from where Tippy was here.
Did you know Officer Tippett?
Yes, I saw him pretty many times.
And did you hear the shots?
Yes, I heard the shots.
And what did you do?
I ran out into the street and looked down the street, and I ran back down the street where he was lying, and I looked at him.
Now, when you heard the shots and you went out of the house, did you see a man with a gun?
Yes, I did.
What was he doing?
Oh, he was reloading it.
And how would you describe that man?
Well, he's kind of chunky. He's kind of heavy. He wasn't a very big man.
Was he tall or short?
Yeah, he was kind of short guy.
Short and heavy?
Yes.
And was there any other man there?
Yes, there was one on the side of the street. All I know, he told him to go.
Mrs. Clemens, the man who had the gun, did he make any motion at all to the other man across the street?
No more, I told him to go.
Well, he waved his hand,
yes,
and said, go on.
Gone.
And then what happened with the man with the gun?
He unloaded and reloaded.
And what did the other man do?
Man kept going straight down the street.
And then did they go in opposite directions?
Yes, they were. They weren't together. They went this way from each other. The one down the shooting went this way. Other one went straight down past the street that way.
What was the man who did not do the shooting, but the man who went in the other direction from the man with the gun? What was he wearing, if you remember?
Well, I can remember he looked like light khakis and a white shirt.
And was he tall or short?
He was tall.
And was he heavy or thin?
He was thin.
But the one who did the one who had the gun, seconds after Tippett was shot, he was short.
Yes,
he was,
heavy. Was short and kind of heavy.
Now, did you testify before the Warren Commission about this case?
I haven't said anything to anyone.
Did anyone come to see you after the murder of Officer Tippett?
Yes, he was a man who came. I don't know what he was. He came to my house and talked to me. But I don't know what he looked like, a policeman to me.
He did. Did he have a gun?
Yes, he wore a gun.
Mrs. Clemens, how long after Tippett was shot did this man with a gun come to visit you?
About two days. It's about 2 days. Said that I might get hurt. Someone might hurt me if I would talk.
About what you saw?
What I saw. He just told me to be the best if I didn't say anything because I might get hurt.
So according to Aquila Clemens, she witnessed two men who appeared to be acting in concert immediately following the shooting of Officer J.D. Tippett. She described one as a short, stocky man who was visibly armed and holding a gun. The armed individual headed in the same direction as the man other witnesses later identified as Lee Harvey Oswald. The second man, unarmed, walked eastward down 10th Street. Clemens' account raises two critical questions. Was there an accomplice? Her testimony suggests the possibility of a second man involved in the crime, potentially serving as an unarmed accomplice. Was the shooter misidentified? Clemens described the gunman as short and chunky, a physical profile that contrasts sharply with other witness descriptions of the suspect, who was generally portrayed as lean and of average height, more consistent with Oswald's build. Her story has gained attention over the years, not only for its contradictions to the official narrative, but also because of what she revealed to Mark Lane. Clemens claimed she was never interviewed by the Warren Commission. More troubling, she said that an unidentified law enforcement officer warned her to remain silent about what she had seen. This alleged intimidation, combined with her divergent account, has fueled speculation that key witness testimony may have been suppressed, casting further doubt on the lone gunman theory. Quilla Clemens remains one of the most enigmatic figures in the investigation of Officer J.D. Tippett's murder. Her eyewitness account, describing two men at the scene, one of whom was short and stocky and holding a gun, challenged the official narrative and suggested the possibility of an accomplice. Yet after her appearance in Mark Lane's 1966 documentary Rush to Judgment, Clemens seemingly disappeared from public view. Conspiracy theorists have long speculated that something sinister may have happened to her. Some believe she was silenced or intimidated into vanishing, possibly due to the alleged warning she received from a law enforcement officer who told her to, quote, keep quiet or she might get hurt, end quote. This chilling detail, which she shared with Lane, has fueled decades of suspicion. On the other hand, defenders of the Warren Report argue that Clemens likely died of natural causes and that her absence from the commission's investigation was due to oversight or her reported poor health. According to some sources, the FBI declined to take a formal statement from her because she suffered from diabetes, a condition they claim made her an unreliable witness. Despite extensive efforts by researchers and amateur investigators, no definitive record of Clemens' later life or death has been found. Some have tried tracing her through marriage records, obituaries, her family connections. The mystery of Akilah Clemens, her testimony, her disappearance, and the lack of official follow-up continues to haunt those who question the Lone Gunman theory. Whether she was ignored, intimidated, or simply faded into obscurity, her story remains a powerful reminder of how fragile and contested eyewitness accounts can be in the shadow of history. Frank Wright also emerged as a critical yet overlooked witness in the investigation of Officer J.D. Tippit's murder. His account was uncovered not by official investigators, but by independent researchers, George and Patricia Nash, who canvassed the neighborhood in search of untapped testimony. Wright lived in an apartment on 10th Street, near the scene of J.D. Tippit's shooting. Like Akilah Clemens, Wright claimed to have seen another individual involved in the incident. Someone who fled the scene immediately after the shots were fired. Recalling what he saw when he stepped outside, Wright stated, quote, I saw a man standing in front of the car. He was looking toward the man on the ground. He stood there for a while and looked at the man. The man who was standing in front of him was about medium height. He had on a long coat. It ended just above his hands. I didn't see any gun. He ran around on the passenger side of the police car. He ran as fast as he could go and got into his car. His car was a gray little old coupe. It was about a 1950 to 51, maybe a Plymouth. It was parked on the same side of the street as the police car. It was heading away from me. He got into his car and drove away as quick as you could see. After he got into the middle of the next block, between Patton and Crawford, I didn't look at him anymore, end quote. Despite the specific detail of Wright's account, including a detailed description of the suspect's vehicle, he was never contacted by the Warren Commission. That omission is especially puzzling, given that Wright's wife was the person who called the police to request an ambulance for Tippit. While other neighbors also phoned in, police records list the shooting location as 501 East 10th Street, the Wright's address. In fact, the ambulance that responded to the scene was dispatched directly to their home. Yet neither Frank Wright nor his wife were interviewed by the Warren Commission, raising serious questions about the thoroughness and selectivity of the investigation. Wright's testimony, like Clemens, suggests the presence of another suspect, one who escaped in a vehicle, contradicting the narrative that Oswald fled on foot. These accounts add layers to complexity to the Tippit shooting and continue to fuel debate over whether the fuel truth was ever officially acknowledged. One of the most controversial witnesses cited by critics of the Warren Report in defense of Lee Harvey Oswald is Warren Reynolds, a used car dealer who operated a lot at 500 East Jefferson Boulevard, just a block from the scene of Officer J.D. Tippit's murder. Shortly after the shooting, Reynolds gave a statement to a local news outlet describing how he saw the gunman fleeing.
And when he got to the corner there, well, he put the gun in his belt like this, and then he walked up the street.
And what did you do?
Well, I ran out to where I was even with him, and then I walked on the opposite side of the street, even with him. When he got to the service station, he went behind it, and I ran over and went behind it too, but I couldn't find him. I looked in the cars, under the cars, and I couldn't find him.
Were you actually trying to catch him or just keep up with him?
Just keep up with him.
And what happened then?
Evidently he got away and the police came, and I went on back to work.
Reynolds was interviewed by the Warren Commission on January 21, 1964, where he stated that he could not possibly identify Oswald as the man he had seen fleeing with a gun. Just 2 days later, Reynolds was shot in the head by an unknown assailant who had been lying in wait in the basement of his car dealership. Reynolds later described the incident.
Well, when I walked in, I went to turn these lights off. I turned these first two switches before a man shot me that was hidden right behind me. And then I ran out of the building.
Did you get a look at the man?
Not a good look.
Did you see him to be able to tell anything about him?
No, sir.
Miraculously, Reynolds survived the attack. After recovering, he reversed his earlier statement and identified Oswald as the gunman, first in a March affidavit and later in a follow-up appearance before the Warren Commission. This sudden change in testimony has long fueled conspiracy theories. The timing of the attempted murder, just days after Reynolds expressed doubt about Oswald's guilt, has led many to suspect intimidation. Decades later, Dallas researcher Michael Brownlow tracked down Reynolds, who was still working in the car business. After initially denying his identity, Reynolds eventually admitted who he was. When asked why he changed his story, he reportedly said, quote, "because I wanted to live," end quote. One major point of contention between witnesses of the J.D. Tippit shooting lies in the varying description of the suspect's appearance. Domingo Benavidez described the gunman as approximately 5'10", wearing a light beige jacket and dark trousers. He noted the man had a complexion, quote, "a little darker than average." That doesn't describe Oswald's complexion at all. He was very pale. Helen Markham said the shooter had black hair, dark trousers, and a tan jacket. She estimated his age around 18 and described his complexion as, quote, "red." Barbara Davis, sister of Virginia Davis, claimed the man wore a black jacket. William Scalkins, a cab driver, reported the shooter wore dark trousers and a jacket darker than the one later recovered by police, which was a tan jacket. Ted Calloway described the suspect as about 5'10", with a fair complexion and dark hair, dressed in dark trousers and a tan jacket. There's mostly agreement among the witnesses that the shooter wore dark trousers and stood around 5'10". However, the jacket color varies greatly, ranging from light beige to tan to black. And notably, Helen Markham, the Warren Report's key witness, described the shooter as having black hair and a red complexion, a detail echoed by both Ted Calloway and Domingo Benavidez. Another piece of evidence that could potentially exonerate Lee Harvey Oswald as a suspect comes from a radio transmission received by the police dispatcher between 1:33 and 1:40 p.m. Officer H.W. Summers reported, quote, "I got an eyeball witness to the getaway man, that suspect in the shooting. He is a white male, 27, 5 feet 11 inches, 165 pounds, black wavy hair, fair complected, wearing a light gray Eisenhower type jacket, dark trousers, and a white shirt, and was last seen running on the north side of the street from Patton onto Jefferson, and was apparently armed with a .32 dark finish automatic pistol, which he had in his right hand," end quote. Notably, the Warren Commission failed to mention this radio call from Officer Summers and did not investigate the identity of the, quote, "eyeball witness" he referenced. What makes Summers' description particularly intriguing is the mention of black wavy hair, unlike Lee Harvey Oswald's, and the identification of a .32 automatic pistol, rather than a .38 Smith & Wesson revolver allegedly used in Officer Tippit's murder. The visual distinction between a revolver and an automatic pistol is significant. Revolvers feature a prominent revolving cylinder, while automatics do not. Conspiracy theorists argue that someone familiar with firearms would almost certainly recognize whether the weapon was a revolver. Such a misidentification seems highly improbable. Adding to the confusion, just minutes after Summers' transmission, Sergeant Gerald Heer informed the dispatcher, quote, "The shell at the scene indicates the suspect is armed with an automatic 38 rather than a pistol," end quote.
Who found what? How did they find the shells? They can't remember the name of the cops because they're there to plant evidence. They're not there with a chain of custody. The shell casings of the previous shooting, the Tippit shooting, are multiple automatic shells. And the officer who phones it in, Jerry Hill, who's another liar, Sergeant Jerry Hill, he's one of the fixers on the Dallas Police Force, he phones into headquarters that the killer has a 38 automatic. Now, Oswald had a revolver, so having a 38 automatic is not good. And he knows it's a 38 automatic because he looks at the shell casings, and on the bottom of the shell casings that a witness gives him at the site of the Tippit murder, it says 38 auto on the bottom of the shell, so it came from an automatic. Plus, you've got Winchester shell casings and another brand. So you've got a mixed brand of shell casings at the crime scene itself of the Tippit.
One of the most debated aspects of the J.D. Tippit murder is the ballistic evidence. Specifically, the relationship between the bullets recovered from Tippit's body and the shell casings found at the crime scene. While many researchers agree that Tippit was struck by four bullets, matching the four shell casings recovered, the details raise troubling inconsistencies. First, we have the shell casings at the scene. Four shell casings were found at the scene, consisting of two Winchester and two Remington Peters brands. These match the type used in the 38 special revolver Oswald was carrying when arrested. But during the autopsy of Tippit's body, they recovered three Winchester bullets and one Remington, creating a mismatch between the brands of shells and the bullets. So what about the FBI analysis? Cortland Cunningham, an FBI ballistics expert, testified that the bullets were too damaged to conclusively link them to Oswald's revolver. While the FBI did not rule out Oswald's gun, they could not definitively match the bullets to it. So what about the shell casings? The Warren Commission's firearm experts concluded that the shell casings did match test shells from Oswald's revolver. This finding is often cited as damning evidence against Oswald. However, questions remain about the chain of custody. Two of the shells were recovered by witness Domingo Benavidez, who handed them to Officer J.M. Poe. Poe claimed he was instructed by Sergeant Gerald Heer to mark the shells with his initials, which he said he did. But get this. The shells currently held in the National Archives do not bear Poe's initials, raising doubts about whether the same shells were examined by the FBI. There's also the chain of custody concerns. Critics like James D. Eugenio argue that the shells were not included in the original evidence summary and were only sent to the FBI 6 days after the Bureau had already concluded the bullets couldn't be matched to Oswald's revolver. This delay and lack of clear markings suggests the possibility that the FBI may not have examined the same shells Benavidez originally handed over. Something interesting is during Oswald's arrest at the Texas Theater, Officer Nick McDonald reported hearing the hammer click as Oswald allegedly tried to fire the revolver. However, FBI expert Cunningham contradicted this, stating that none of the cartridges showed evidence of a firing pin strike, implying the gun may have not been fired at all. This discrepancy has led some to question whether the revolver was functional or whether McDonald's account was mistaken or exaggerated. The ballistics evidence in the Tippit case is a tangled web of partial matches, missing markings, and contradictory testimony. While the shell casings were linked to Oswald's revolver, the bullets were not, and the chain of custody issues, combined with conflicting accounts of the gun's functionality, leave room for serious doubt. Next week in Part 4 of our series, The Murder of Officer J.D. Tippit, we look at one of the strongest arguments for why Oswald could not have been the killer of Tippit, and that's the timing doesn't work out based on Oswald's documented movements. Another disputed area in this case is the discovery of the light gray zip-up jacket that supposedly belonged to Oswald and was worn by him at the time of the Tippit shooting. We'll take a look at details about the jacket next week. Another mystery in this case has to do with Oswald's wallet. How many wallets did he own, and how many were recovered that day? Helen Markham told the police that Tippett's killer leaned on the ledge of J.D. Tippett's police car on the passenger side door. Were there prints of Lee Harvey Oswald found on that car? The answer may surprise you. We'll see you next week. If you like what you hear every week and want to learn more about the assassination, please pick up my book, The End of Innocence, The Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's available right now on Amazon, or you can find it at www.endofinnocencejfk.com. In honor of the release of the JFK assassination records, I'm sending out signed copies of my book. If you would like one of these, please email me at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com. The price is $40 for the soft cover and $60 for the hardcover, plus shipping and handling. I can promise you, you won't be disappointed in the book. It's an oversized coffee table style book. The book is over 500 pages with almost 1,000 pictures. You won't be disappointed. And hey, send me your comments about the book or this podcast at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com.